appreciate Pat, on the one hand, suggesting that I'm teaching the doctrine of men, and on the other hand, suggesting that you give full attention to those doctrines of men as I teach them. Thank you, Pat, for that. However, I think you're quite mistaken. The inclusion of little children in the faith is something taught directly by God repeatedly throughout all of the Bible, especially as it began in the foundational days of the Old Covenant with regard to Abraham. I would like for you to respond to this argument, which I laid out earlier. I know that, I don't know what we're going to do next. We're going to have a question and answer now? What's following this? This is it?
Well, I'll give one more speech and that'll be it.
Okay. Well, so, I hope you respond to this. This is a systematic argument. Now, I know Pat is very proud of being able to pull a text out here and out there and cite it like that. That's not my methodology. I'm trying to tell you what the text means as it unfolds in the context and what it means throughout the Bible, or what a theme means from beginning to end. I've mentioned household. I've shown how the household of Abraham was included in the faith, that there was a covenant made between Abraham and his descendants after him, which included his children expressly, and it was a household inclusion, which included infants that were born into the household, or servants that were born into the household, or adopted. Pat has questioned me on this point. He says, well, if you can't prove that any of these households have infants, then you haven't proven your point. My argument has not been that these have infants in them, although I think even if we go with your 20% rule, we have five households, 20%, one of those households has infants in it, and they're all manifestly baptized. Therefore, even by that standard, you could say there's some indication that some household, it would be unlikely that the five households that Luke picks to show the gospel advancing, none of them have little children in them. I think that's hard to believe, especially in a world where they do want children. That's not our world, but it was their world. They wanted little children. They had a lot of children. They sought to have children, and they have five households. These are, again, this is an overwhelming case that there is a continuation from the Old Testament to the New Testament, that God's purpose in His covenant redemption goes to entire clans, goes to households. It is the inclusion of the household. The emphasis is there. It's plain here. It's plain specifically in the purpose statement of the book of Acts, that the gospel go from Jerusalem to the farthest parts of the earth. It shows this. It shows that the way the gospel transverses cultures is it goes to Crispus or Cornelius or to the jailer, and their household is included. Now, their household as a household. So if they have a child born into the household the next day, that household, that child's included. If they have a daughter that's adopted into the household later, which happens very frequently in the early parts of early years of Christianity, then that child is included. That's my point. Now let me try to move on, though, because I do want to point out that when you look at who was baptized, you have this case made very plainly. The first Gentile has a house that's baptized. The second pagan Gentile has a house that's baptized. And if you look again at everything that we see in the New Testament about baptism, you notice a strong emphasis upon the inclusion of households. Now, several passages have been brought up that I want to try to address this in as much as I can. 1 Peter 3:21. This text, Pat made it as though the word appeal involves some kind of the person appealing, that it's got to be an act of participation. Well, notice that washing and cleansing rites in the Old Testament involve all kinds of different activities. There are things washed passively. There are people that are sprinkled with the book, and the book of the law was sprinkled with blood and ashes and so forth in the days of Moses. That was called the baptism in Hebrews chapter 9. There are all kinds of things. Here, the word that is for the word Tama is a word that is translated sometimes appeal. It's the answer. The answer is the way the New King James renders it. The answer of a good conscience toward God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I think this text is very rich because it says at the beginning of it that baptism is an antitype, and literally the Greek text, antitypos, an antitype to what? To the flood. The point of this verse is that the flood included both death and salvation. And so it is with baptism. Martin Luther, a Protestant reformer, had a great prayer that he used to use during baptismal services. And it included this idea that God drowned hard-hearted Pharaoh through the flood, and now may God drown in us all that we have through Adam, and all that we've added thereunto in our own sins. That is, that baptism signifies, just like the flood, two things. It signifies the death, and it signifies resurrection. That's what this text is referring to. Now, of course, most of the baptismal language in the New Testament is oriented toward adults. And so Pat, again, as I said, he followed the red herring, or the red catfish herring, if you will, by saying, look, the eunuch, he had to believe before he's baptized. Of course, that's what we all agree about. Adult converts have to believe before they're baptized. But then, what do you do with the eunuch's children? What do you do with Crispus' children? What do you do with Cornelius' children, or Stephanus, or Lydia, or the jailer? What do you do? That's the question we have with regard to infant baptism. It's the question of what do you do with the faithful person's own children? Are they to be included in the faith? If so, does that include baptism? I think yes, because their household is included. Now, please notice, if you look at verse 14 of Acts chapter 11, we have the same point made to the jailer. Again, the jailer and Cornelius have a very important parallel relationship. The Cornelius household is the first household that's a Gentile household to be baptized. The Philippian jailer is the only example we have of an out-and-out pagan. Because, again, Cornelius is a God-fearer. He's acquainted with the ways of Israel at some level. But the jailer is now not pagan. But look what it says in 11:14. When the angel tells Peter what is he going to do when he goes to Cornelius, it's you and your household that will be saved. That's the same thing that's said with the jailer. Again, what must I do to be saved? Believe in the Lord Jesus and you shall be saved, you and your household. In the passage of the jailer, look how many times the concept of the household is there. Repeatedly, over and over again, he and his household. Now again, the reason why that's important is because Luke is telling us how the gospel goes from here to there. This is a long passage, relatively long, about baptism. Why is it long? Because the jailer himself is the first out-and-out pagan that we have an example of being baptized. This is precisely what Acts 1:6 through 8 is talking about. This is how the gospel goes from Jerusalem to the remotest part of the earth. The people in Jerusalem knew very well that their household was included. They knew that infants were included. They knew that children were included because the promise is to you and your children, as it says in Acts 2:39. Here in Acts 16, we have, again, a repeated emphasis upon this whole household. Look at that. Look at the yellow text. You and your household will be saved. He and all his household were baptized. His whole household believed in God and rejoiced. Actually, if you read very carefully the text, it says, the Philippian jailer, singular, rejoiced greatly, singular, having believed in God with his whole household. It's actually an adverb. It's very consistent with what Joshua would have said in Joshua 24. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That's the head of the household speaking for the house. That's exactly the framing of the language here. The emphasis in this pet text, and also in Acts 18, where it's Crispus and his household. Crispus believed with his household. Very precise Greek word there. Soon, it's not the word kai, it's not and. Believed with his whole household in the Lord. It's a very clear statement. The head of household is leading the household in the action. It's a singular verb. It's not emphasizing that every individual in the household believes. It's just to say, if you ask me, does every member of my household believe? Yes, they do. Is every member of your household, you know, persuaded of, you know, some doctrine I believe in? I could say, we believe this. But every individual has their own variations on those sort of things. This is very consistent covenantal language, just like you find in the Old Testament. Abraham and his household were taught the way of the Lord. That's the language of Genesis 18, 19. Okay, let me go back and catch a few things that I want to make. I want to make a point, first of all. Again, my methodology is different than Pat's. Pat is concerned about the text, citing them in a way that provides a proof text for what he's doing. I'm concerned to say, what does the unfolding revelation of the Bible teach us? And I've tried to do that with Acts, with Acts 1:8, and I'm going to also do that with the background to baptism. Why is there baptism? Maybe Pat can answer this for us. Why, first of all, Pat, if you want two targets, why are there 9 individuals that are baptized in 5 are households? If the point is, after all, households don't really matter, it's just individuals. Why does God reveal it that way, successively through Acts? The second question is, why baptism at all? Why is there washing at all? Why is there any baptism? Why does John come and baptize in the wilderness? Why does Jesus' disciples baptize? Why do we have a great commission with baptism? Why? The answer to that, in my understanding of the Bible, is that the Old Testament prophets, especially, prophesied that in the New Covenant era, when the Messiah would come, he would wash the nation Israel and the other nations. That the whole point was a collective transformation of both Israel and other nations. For example, in Ezekiel 36:24 and following, I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. That's a paramount new covenant promise when the Pharisees and Sadducees came out to see John. They walked out and they said, why are you baptizing if you are not the Messiah or Elijah or the prophet? Because they expected someone to be doing something fulfilling this text in Ezekiel 36. You might notice, by the way, the methodology of baptism there. But the point really is cleansing. God would cleanse the nation Israel. That's collective. That includes children. That includes the household. No Israelite ever would have thought his children were excluded from those kinds of sins. Their children were included in the sacrificial rites, like Passover. Their children were included in circumcision. They would not have thought, oh, now in the New Covenant, only adults. Not at all. Isaiah 52, the passage that the Ethiopian eunuch himself was reading. He was reading Isaiah 53. This is a few verses before that, Isaiah 52:15. The text says, the suffering servant will sprinkle or cleanse many nations. That's the background to why John is baptizing and why then Jesus gives a command to baptize. In fact, all of the Old Testament is full of promises that the nations would come to the Lord, thus be cleansed from their Gentile uncleanness, and thus baptism in the New Testament. All the ends of the earth may fear him. All nations serve him. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord. And all the families of the nations will worship before thee. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. You see, the baptism of nations is exactly what Matthew 28 commands. And it commands it precisely because the prophetic purpose of God was to cleanse the nation Israel and then the rest of the world. That's what the New Covenant is all about. And all of the imagery that comes in the Old Testament, tabernacle and temple, fulfill that. Think about the tabernacle. If you walk up to the tabernacle, if this is the tabernacle, and you walk up to the front door, what is right at the door before you come in? Well, a laver. A laver a lot like what this looks like. Right there. A laver. Or maybe more precisely, something looks like that. A laver. A baptismal font. Now, why is it on a pedestal? Why is it like that? Why is this? This is a historic. I took this picture in Italy, actually. This historic baptismal font. That's like the labor of the Old Testament. Why? Because there's water above the heavens and there's water down on the ground. And the water above the heavens is what the prophets see when they see cleansing. That's why the water comes down. That's why the Spirit of God was poured out, and it's called the baptism of the Spirit. Because there's something about the water above the heavens. That's a Genesis 1 reference. So there's a pedestal built up, and in the temple furniture and the tabernacle furniture have that very imagery, that there's water above coming down. In fact, for example, if you move on through the Old Testament tabernacle into the temple, what happens if you walk up to the temple? Let's suppose we're all walking to the temple. You have to walk through a gauntlet of water chariots, of bowls of water on chariots that signify water that flows. Because you have to pass through the Red Sea. You have to go through the water. You have to be baptized in the cloud and in the sea to get back to God, to, as it were, get back to Eden. Or, look at Ezekiel's temple. The same thing is true. In Ezekiel's temple, you have to walk through and you see the water flowing deeper and deeper to go out to the rest of the world to cleanse the nations in Ezekiel's visionary temple. In chapter 48 of the prophet Ezekiel. Now, I think that what I want to point out, see, is there was an expectation that the nations themselves would be washed. Nations include children. When Jesus commanded that they make disciples of all nations, he certainly intended that children would come to him, because Jesus himself said that, didn't he? He said, "Do not forbid the children to come to me." And if someone does that, it would be better if he put a millstone around his neck. Well, let me try to respond to a few of Pat's
points.
Pat said in the last talk something to the effect of, well, if children must be baptized and so forth, what if they're not born into a Presbyterian home? What if they're not born into a home that baptizes them? Well, my claim would be that children of Christians are part of the covenant. The covenant is most formally signified in baptism. But I wouldn't necessarily believe that a person can't be faithful without baptizing their children. I just think they're misled about the nature of baptism. Now, when he says the difference between the old covenant and the new covenant is exactly this point, children are not included, it's every man for himself. He is denying specifically what just about 30 or 40 verses say. The entire New Covenant range of promises from Deuteronomy 30, verse 6 and following, all include the descendants. Please notice, Deuteronomy 30, verse 6 through 9. I will circumcise the heart of your descendants after you. Or in the very passage that Pat read, I noticed that he read verse 31 and following, but he never made it to 37. Not a surprise. Not a surprise at all. Verse 37, 35, 36, and into 37 say this: "But the offspring of Israel shall not cease from being a nation before me forever." In other words, the very new covenant promise includes an inclusion of children. There are many verses that say that in so many ways. Luke 2:49, the mother of our Lord said, "His mercy is upon generation after generation of those who fear him." Look at that text. This is a New Testament verse that says the generational promise still exists. What's my time now?
Got 1 minute.
Or Acts 2:39, which I've already alluded to. Again, these are people in the Bible that did believe their children are part of the covenant. Therefore, baptism applies. Again, look at that pattern. Look at that pattern of how many household cases there are. This is an astounding point that Pat, I hope, will be able to respond to at some point before this evening is out. Thank you.